Hi, welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Andrew Kavanagh. Joining me is John Purcell and one of Australia's favourite authors, Tony Jordan. Thanks for coming in, Tony.
Thanks so much, Andrew. Hi, John.
Hi. Our Tiny Useless Hearts is your new book.
That's it. Our Tiny Useless Hearts.
And are they?
They are pathetic. I reckon we... don't you think that we are just not very good at loving each other? That's what I think. I think we should be better at it. Considering it's so important in our lives, we need to love better.
Well, that's true. If we were good at it, I guess that would eliminate about 90% of the dramatic works of the
Yes, well, that's true. Maybe we shouldn't be any better than
that. No, the whole industry crashes.
No, I don't like that.
I fix the heart problem.
Just keep being rubbish at it, and then we can keep telling stories about it.
Whenever I hear anyone talk about their hearts being not great, there's a line from the song from Everything But the Girl, the mind may grow wise, but the heart remains a child. I always think of that.
Absolutely true.
That's a reference for the early 90s trip-hop fans out there, for Everything But a Girl.
Yes, the ancient ones.
But Tony, let's talk about the book, because it is, in a way, you're coming full circle with the writing as well.
Very much. I started with, my first book was a romantic comedy, because it's a very natural kind of way for me to write. I just love stories. And it's a struggle to try and not be funny, like not crack jokes at things. So I've written serious books before, but it's always a bit more effort. But so my natural default, the sitting at home in the jammies kind of writing business default, is kind of cracking jokes at things.
Do you, when you're writing your serious works, do you have a file open going, can't put it in, I'll have to just file it away for the next work of comedy?
No jokes.
But you can read it with someone who has that natural levity in their voice and their way of looking at things, that it is, I guess, a little bit, not cathartic's probably the wrong word, but there is obviously, you always want to read someone who's confident and comfortable about what they're doing. Clearly with this, from what John's been telling me, I haven't read it, we'll say that out.
True, it's not crashed.
It's not out for a little bit. John's been the one who's sequestered in the office.
I stole the proof.
But with the banter that's there, and I've looked through pages, it does seem like you're really comfortable with that back and forth.
I really love dialogue. I think dialogue is just the most important thing about, for me, about novels, because when people speak, they reveal who they are and they reveal what matters to them. And if you work a little bit at that, you can have these people really coming alive on the page in terms of what they say.
But a lot of authors get into it's quite tricky to manage all those different voices coming out.
Oh, yeah. There's like seven people all talking at once, all with different sort of agendas. But I love getting my teeth into that kind of scene. That's really one of my favourite things to do.
And when you start, these characters seem very noisy, and they seem like the kind of characters that might just stay in your head and drive you nuts as you're doing the shopping.
They're flat out.
Yeah, because they're constant talkers.
Yeah. And, you know, the early drafts, they were even worse. There was just so much talking. And my poor editor kind of had her head in her hand saying, you know, it's not a screenplay, right? You know, it's actually a novel. It's like, oh yeah, that's right. So I have to sort of go back and keep that in mind. So all my work is dialogue heavy. I know that, I find people fascinating when they talk.
Let's backtrack a bit. Can you give us just a kind of a bit of a setup for the novel?
So actually, I stole the setup of the novel from Tolstoy. I know, that's
not a bad place.
Tolstoy with jokes and sex scenes. But I was reading Anna Karenina while I was on holidays last year, and I completely loved it. People had told me to read it for years. It was embarrassing that I hadn't. And it sort of begins in this, there's actually a sentence somewhere that goes, the house was in turmoil because the husband's affair with the governess had been discovered. And I just thought, this was at the very beginning, I just thought, what a sensational setup. Like, it's the morning after the affair has been discovered. Mm-hmm. And in Tolstoy, in Anna Karenina, Anna is the husband's sister, and she has to come in and kind of soothe the household and calm everything down. And in Our Tiny Useless Hearts, my main character, Janice, is the wife's sister. But it's that same sort of setup. It's that waking up in the morning and everything has changed and people are still kind of shell-shocked from yelling last night. And then we go on from there, and there's all these kind of... I kind of think of it as a traditional old-fashioned bedroom farce about people hiding in cupboards naked and that kind of thing, getting caught in the wrong bedrooms, all taking place over one weekend.
And I can tell from the end of the book that you're a bit of a keen gardener, is that right?
Oh, I love a bit of gardening. But Don, you probably are the only person here that knows what that means.
I'm aware what that means. John did mention it, so people at home will.
Well, yeah, they'll be surprised. The interesting thing is that I love writing sex scenes, and I love writing sex scenes that go unexpected places. But there's also two children in this book, two small children. And of course, the adults can't quite speak as frankly as they might if there was not two children in this book. So they have to use all kind of ways to get around this idea of talking about sex without talking about sex, and one of them is gardening. So so yes, there's kind of some conversations around that.
Yeah, at the beginning there's fruit salad, at the end there's a garden.
Yeah, that's right. It's about all these analogies about, you know, modern life is really complicated. Like, you know, I have two ex-husbands somewhere out there. Hello, ex-husbands. who I haven't seen in, you know, decades.
Thank you for the material.
Yes, thank you so much. But, you know, modern life is really complicated. We have these kind of history of people that we were once connected to, and then, you know, in-laws that we were once connected to. And there's a big net about these strange relationships and how they work. I think it's fascinating.
And everyone matures at a different time. And so you have these different perspectives happening. Is it Martha?
Martha is the...
So Martha is kind of straightforward, thinks she's got everything worked out and is grown up.
Yeah.
And just wants to be adult and solve this issue. We're all adults here. We can solve this issue. It's as easy as 1, 2, 3.
Exactly. Everyone sort of comes from a different perspective. But it doesn't seem to get any simpler as you get older. There's just different ways of misunderstanding other people, if you like.
And the subtext with a dull or heavy book is tricky, but I imagine when you nail it, and John has told me that you do nail it, that when you get it, it must be great because you can say so much with a sentence. It's difficult to... I mean, let's be honest, in this world, some people can't even trace sarcasm when they actually hear it.
But
when you're able to deliver it on the page, it must just open this key that you're able to get
there. I love this idea. This is something that's really important to me that I've always tried to do through all my books, is that having the reader know more than the people in the story, than the protagonist in the story, even with a first-person story, I want the reader to understand more of what's going on than the people in the scene. And that's, you know, it's not easy in the first draft, but eventually it comes together. So you think about where is that space, you know? The reader, I think of, there's seven characters in this book, but I really try and think that there's eight and the reader is one. And if they were sitting around at that table, what would they be picking up from this conversation that the characters themselves don't see?
So between chapters, you can kind of do the 18th century, well, dear reader, what do we think of this?
I would love to have that in. I'll just put it down there and let's just have a chat.
I think that's missing in a lot of modern books, is that direct approach to the reader. It seems to got thrown out in the whole modernism age. Distrusted, but I think it could probably come back.
Yeah, I think so. If you can speak to the reader, that's empowering the reader, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ultimately, yeah. One thing that we're really excited to talk about. I want to talk about your writing career.
Oh yeah.
Because it's quite fascinating. Because a lot of people at home, and I certainly thought there is sort of a conveyor belt towards writing, and you love books, you read as a child, and then in this explosion of YA where a 16-year-old can be a best-selling author, you just assume that, well, that's just what you do.
Yes, I wrote my first bestseller at 16, no.
But you, you're obviously an incredibly passionate writer and reader, but it took a while for you to really get started and really throw everything in to that project.
Yeah, I loved it at school, of course, as you guys obviously did. But, you know, it just didn't seem like a real kind of job sort of thing. I come from a very sort of family where not everybody went to university or finished school, and it was kind of important that you got a job that led to a proper thing. And I always did like science. I'm a big fan of science, always have been. So I
actually... There's a bit of nerdy stuff in here.
Yeah, there's science in all my books. I can't get away from it. So I left school at the end of year 12 and got a job in a mailroom, actually. And it, by luck, it was a mailroom at the University of Queensland in the physiology department. Wow. And after a couple of years organising opening letters, they let me take time off during the day to go to lectures and then make it up at night. And they put me in a research assistant role before they should have, like before I was properly graduated. And so I ended up working in research there for about 5 years in bench research, in kind of molecular biology was really my field. Then I got another job in a biotechnology company where we made enzymes, and that was great, did that for a while. And then I ran a lab for a pharmaceutical company, testing, quality testing drugs and pills. So that was fun too. And all these times, still reading, of course, but it just seemed, I mean, I know people wrote books for a living. I mean, obviously they came from somewhere, but it wasn't people like me. You know, it was people that had a special kind of
tweed people. Jackets.
Yeah. Very, very different people from me. And then so I got a few other jobs in that same sort of field. And then I got a job in Reg Affairs, which means I had to write the dossiers for new drugs to be registered, which are like, you know, 4 inches thick kind of serious things that take a year to write.
Ever sneak in a joke?
You would be, I would be very tempted just to put something in brackets. I don't believe anyone actually reads these because they're monsters, you know. Yeah. But it was the first time that I was sitting down at a desk sort of writing of some description, and I just really loved it. And then I thought, well, I'll go back to uni and get a qualification in technical writing, and then I can freelance as a technical writer instead of working for the one company, have my own little business. And so I went, enrolled in a little diploma, and then while there, I chose a creative writing subject, which was novel writing. And my first book edition was the first assignment for that course. And I just kept writing it and writing it. So it was, I was 35 by the time I'd even written any fiction. So definitely not 16. And yeah, and that was my first piece of writing.
Well, I just want to apologise to any writers out there who have never got published and have 16 different manuscripts in their drawers.
But I was
doesn't
old.
Happen like this.
Yeah. I was old, John. I had a lot of, I had, you know, runs on the... Life experience. That's
yeah. Live, people, live. Well, it's fascinating. I mean, yeah, and so do you think, I mean, we talked about the ex-husbands and everything, but I mean, how heavily, if you had to put a percentage on mining real life and mining things that you've read, where do you go with your fiction as far as inspiration?
I think my life is dead boring, except for possibly the periods of the ex-husbands. Really pretty boring. Like, I live a pretty normal life in a normal house in a normal suburb.
I thought you said there...
Yeah, no.
There wasn't.
No, sorry, no. Okay. No, none of the escapades belong to me. Maybe it's wishful thinking, Andrew. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, alternate reality about what I wish my life was like.
Now I have this image of you in your writing den with petri dishes and putting a little bit of character in this one, a little bit of bread and a bit of water, and just seeing what grows out of that. Oh, I've got this character out of that petri dish.
It's just like that. But you know, actually, I think that people kind of feel that science and the arts are very separate disciplines. Mm. And something that I've thought increasingly is that they're really not. When you're working in science, you need an enormous amount of creativity to solve these problems that come up. Your job is to solve problems and find solutions and find answers to things that you don't know the answers for. And in order to do that, you've first got to envisage possible solutions and then work out a way to test it. And I feel that, like, it's not as separate as you might think.
It didn't used to be. C.P. Snow was complaining about it back in the 50s and 60s, that there were two cultures and it should have been one, because in the past, all the best artists knew their science.
Absolutely.
You just couldn't. You couldn't do. You couldn't. You wouldn't have it if you had an interest in human psychology and human nature. Then you'd want to go to the nth degree, and that means going to science to try and find out the roots of all this. And that fellow Richard Dawkins wrote a book recently. I'm sorry, last 20 years.
Yeah.
Called Unweaving the Rainbow, where he pretty much writes to scientists saying, if art's not coming to us, we'll go to art.
Right.
And you have.
Yes, there you go.
It's interesting. Well, I think Cormac McCarthy as well. I saw an interview and he's pretty much has a university job in Texas where he just sits in a corner office.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, do you hang out with other people in the literary department? He said, no, I hang out with the science department. Because literary people can be quite dogmatic, even with their creativity, whereas science inherently is by you're just discovering new things and you're pushing through boundaries.
That's absolutely your job. And in terms of writing fiction, I've really also discovered that in the way my brain works, it's got these two distinct steps. So I do the first draft, if you like, and I completely just go wild. And I try not to you know, this
embrace the Hemingway.
Wild. Yeah, you just go for it. And part of the challenge of that for me is switching off that analytical brain, because my brain has been normally trained to be quite analytical, and, you know, get out of my own way really is the biggest challenge for that. But then once I have that, and then I have to make it into something, then I have to be really sharp and critical and analytical and look at this sentence. Why is this sentence working? If not, why not? And really drill down in a forensic way.
Interesting. Yeah. Wait, you look like you're about to make a grand point, John.
I
leaned back, listeners. He did the lean back.
Well, yeah, you just don't want to go off on some great diversion, do you? Instead of wonder. Yes. You lead me into these places with these tempting little...
Do you not agree? Is that not how you do things?
No. I think that's. So many people I know have that 30 pages. They rewrite and rewrite, and every word has to be right the first time. It's insane. You can't do that. And you know, I think that having the clay to work with.
Yeah.
You've got to have the clay. You've got to put the clay down, and you can't sculpt without it.
Because it's a different part of your brain.
Yeah.
Getting it perfect from getting it down. They're two different processes for me, anyway.
It's also chipping away a bit of marble or sculpting something, it has its own joys that second.
Absolutely. I find that very satisfying.
Mm.
And you know, great sentences just make me so happy now.
Yeah.
Not just in my own work, like coming across a great sentence in somebody else's work. I do a bit of teaching, and it's, you know, someone this morning in a class had a great sentence, and I was like, oh, that's so good. You get excited about things like that.
No, that's great. I know that we at the Writers Festival last year, we ran into Ben Ockery, and he has a thing where he would walk down the platform, and anybody who's reading a book, he'd say, what's that sentence? Tell me the sentence you're reading now. Tell me the sentence.
That's,
and they'd
say,
scary, like,
really?
Yeah, it's insane. And they look, it's Ben Ockery, you know, and he's like, he's got this incredible charisma. Or it'd be the first sentence, and someone would say, he got up and went to the bathroom, and he'd say, interesting, and keep walking, you know. But it was, I like what you're saying, is that, I think for that true passion for words, you have to appreciate it's like a chord change for a musician.
Yes.
That sentence can just resonate.
But managing both skills is the thing that's the perpetual challenge and delight, is that big picture, artistic, creative, where do these people come from? I've got no idea.
Yeah.
Where do the ideas come from? If I knew, I would go there more often and get better ones. And then this thing, is this the right verb? Is that where the comma goes? You know, managing the large canvas and the tiny microscopic detail, it's a head spin, really. It's great.
I'm glad we covered the Tolstoy aspect early, because I do think that he's a great big fat popular novel, with that dramatic opening.
Yep.
And I think your opening is a little bit more dramatic now. I think you skipped to chapter 2 in your discussion of the opening. The absolute opening is cataclysmic.
Yes. I start with a little flashback, which is something I don't often do. But Janice, my main character, I wanted to capture something of her upbringing. And the book really begins with her remembering her mother smashing every piece of crockery and glassware in the house, like completely just destroying the whole place, I think probably has its seed in my mother can't, just so you guys know, my mother can't operate podcasts. She's not of that sufficient technicality. Reminds me of the time my mother threw a dinner plate with my father's dinner on it at his head, missed him, hit the wall. No damage, no domestic violence, just like a frisbee across the room.
Just a pork cutlet.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of a pro heart kind of acceptance instead of the carpet, the actual wall.
Yeah.
And it was just one dish, but again, it's the seed of something.
Yeah.
So I extrapolated that into this wild kind of smashing, abandoned kind of thing. Big gestures are good. Big gestures are fun.
Well, it's actually quite cathartic at the beginning. You read that opening and you're like, right, I'm ready for anything now.
Yeah. Don't you sometimes want to smash things? I want to smash things.
Oh, absolutely.
I do boxing, you know. This is my new exercise. For the last 12 months I've been doing boxing and kickboxing, and I just could not love it more. And the guy at my boxing gym said, you know, I was kind of embarrassed when I first went there, because it's like, you know, I'm 50 and hanging out with all these, you know, with the gloves, and you feel a bit of a dill. And the guy at the boxing gym said, if menopausal women stopped coming to my boxing gym, I would be out of business. There is a groundswell of women out there who are just furious and want to smash things, want to punch things, and that's my business.
We've often felt that having, I mean, some of the people within the office here, if we had some kind of punching bag hanging down.
That's great.
Yeah.
I think it's good.
I understand your point, but I'm just going to have a smash the punching bag.
Exactly. Exactly.
I think that's good, but I think the interest, the other thing, and when we talk about banter and dialogue in books, and we talk about Wodehouse and the great people that were able to do that, is that I think the art of conversation and the art of subtext and things like that has been lost. And I think there is quite a lot of catharsis that needs to be done, that maybe the book that is heavy on dialogue, and we talk about, obviously, shenanigans of an adult nature, gardening and whatnot.
Yep.
I think that's exciting when you read that in a book, that sort of dialogue, because the art of conversation has gone, and we are, you know, I haven't thrown a plate at someone in a while, but I felt like it.
We can all relate to it, can't we?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it's been an absolute joy, Tony. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thanks so much for making time for me to come in to the spaceship, Booktopia spaceship. I wasn't expecting the flashing lights. I wasn't expecting mechanized legs that go down when you land.
That's true.
And the beams of light that come down and suck you up. It was all new to me. So
it is. But once you're up here, it's fine.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, it's fantastic. And the view.
It's exceptional. Yeah. Lidcombe has never looked so pretty.
Right.
So thank you so much. And if you're listening at home, Our Tiny Useless Hearts is available from booktopia.com.au right now. Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.